Hello and welcome to episode 70 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And now that the royal wedding fever has died down a little bit, we want to take a step back and present to you a detailed conversation with Suhani Jalota, the founder of Maina Mahila Foundation, which is the only Indian nonprofit to be invited to the royal wedding.
The Maina Mahila Foundation is an Indian organization which empowers women by encouraging discussions of taboo topics such as menstruation and by setting up workshops to produce low-cost sanitary protection to enable girls to stay in school. We speak to Suhani about how this amazing journey started and we discuss the intricacies involved in running such a sustainable and cost-efficient organization and how it came into the global spotlight. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show.
Welcome to the show, Suhani. Both you and Maina Mahila Foundation have been all the buzz since the royal wedding, so I'm sure our listeners must also be very keen to learn about this project. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks. It means a lot.
So Suhani, let's start off by telling our listeners a little bit about the Maina Mahila Foundation.
Yeah. So Maina Mahila Foundation was founded by me and a couple of community leaders in various slum communities in Mumbai in 2015 with the mission to empower women to talk about the things that they're most afraid to discuss aloud. The overall goal was essentially to employ local women in their own communities and empower them to talk about menstrual hygiene and domestic violence and sexual assault and anything that makes them uncomfortable right now. So simple question like asking her husband whether she can go out to work or send her daughter to school. We wanted women to be comfortable talking about these topics, which is why we called ourselves Maina as well. So the namesake, Maina is the bird that speaks a lot. So it's a very chatty bird. And in Hindi, we often say that, you know, when our periods are coming, our Mahina is coming, which is the Hindi word for monthly. And so we wanted women to be able to talk about their monthlies or their Mahina like a Maina bird, which is talk a lot about it. So that was essentially the concept of it coming up. And we knew that we wanted to have menstrual hygiene as kind of a means to an end and not the end goal itself. So it is a means to start breaking that ice and start other conversations as well, which we've kind of seen happen over the last few years. So we grew, you know, when it first started, actually, so the foundation officially registered in 2015, but before that, for 6 years, I'd been working with the same women in the same communities on issues of sanitation and toilets before. So when we started, you know, we already had that community trust and built, and we just concentrated on getting our product right, getting our strategies right, and the women on board, and getting them really excited about what they were doing.
So, honey, what did you, we tried to like Google as much as possible about you. And we tried to look at your past and everything. And we read that you studied at Duke University, but we couldn't find out what you studied. So we were just curious, like what your history is before you started giving all your time to the foundation.
Yeah. So at Duke University, I was studying my bachelor's in economics and global health. And that's, essentially, it was something that I was interested in even before. So I was studying at Dhirubhai Ambani International School in Mumbai. I've grown up in really small towns all over the state of Maharashtra because of my father's, government civil service kind of a job. And so I've grown up changing many schools. So when I came to Dhirubhai Ambani School here, that was a pretty, I've been already working in communities in, you know, rural or an urban setting before, in low-income places where it was either for education or for sanitation-related projects. And so at the age of 15, at the school, I was doing a research project in economics on understanding the efficiency of operation maintenance of public toilets in the Dharavi slums in Mumbai. And that project actually really got me in touch with a lot of women with whom I founded Maina Mahila Foundation many years later. And those were the women with whom, you know, I heard all these incredible stories that were so powerful and yet kind of invisible and not really being, visible either to the government or to their own family members or to the world outside. And I really felt that that their voices really needed to be heard on that global platform. So I had gone to Duke. So this was, you know, at school, I finished this research project and then I went to Duke knowing that I want to be helping these women out in some way, shape or form. I had no idea how, but I knew that I'm dedicating my life to this. But I didn't know how it would look. But I knew that it had to be related to healthcare because this was a topic that women didn't speak enough about, but it really cost them their lives. And they were making this constant trade-off between dignity and health, often at the cost of health. So I got a foundation grant essentially from the Gates Foundation and Duke Engage Project in my first year in summer break to do rural sanitation type of research work. And that was to understand why are people in rural areas culturally not demanding toilets in areas where you have access to money and water at the doorstep? And that was a very interesting project to just understand people's psychology behind sanitation and hygiene in some parts of India today. And that was a rural tribal population in rural areas. So again, very different type of a setup. And then I came back to an urban setup to make further parallels and also to expand my scope. So I started working on adolescent girl health and then stunting. And I did my economics thesis project in undergrad, looking at the effect of slum redevelopment on child stunting levels. Because in some of the research that I was doing in sanitation, I found that, you know, even though you couldn't see very direct health outcomes or adverse health outcomes of not using toilets, you'd see often find that children were very, very small and often stunted in areas where toilets were not available. And this was a huge puzzle for me. And I didn't know that people had already done some kind of research into this. So this was an interesting topic for other people. But there was this, you know, the set of researchers that I found in India who were doing some work around this. And I was really interested. And so started digging into this much deeper. And I did my thesis two and a half years of research on that rigorous quantitative analysis. And then, through that project as well, realized that the surveyors that I was training for my surveys were all women who had, you know, known for so many years now, and we wanted to start something together. And that was to empower many more women and go beyond research to do something that is actually actionable and is, you know, a lot more impactful. Because research really takes a lot of time and you really can't directly see its impact either. So even though I am a researcher by heart, I think that entrepreneurial side has come out of this longing for being able to see change. When you find all of this frustration and these invisible voices and you just record them, but you really want to be able to change the narrative somehow. And that's what I think finally got me to Mena Mehta Foundation. And Duke University actually was a huge part of supporting that initiative as well.
Okay, so, you know, we talked about the entrepreneurial side of you, which is why it leads me into the next question. Could you explain this business model that you have in layman terms? Because you have the production of pads, you have a team selling them in slums and hospitals, and this provides employment to women from socially backward communities. That's my sort of understanding of what you do. But could you, in more detail, but also in layman terms, try to explain the business model that you have?
Yeah, actually, you really nailed it. So we have, we're still reliant on donations. So we're not we haven't actually broken even or anything. But essentially, the model is that we would employ local women to manufacture sanitary napkins in our production facility. And these sanitary napkins would then be packaged by our women, would then be sold in the communities, door to door, in public toilets, in clinics, in local metro stations, police stations, and so on. And also maternity napkins that we manufacture would be distributed at maternity homes and in hospitals. And that would further just the money would feed back into the organization to employ women and pay for their salaries and for the office expenses and so on. So, it's a pretty simple operating business model that we follow. We are also trying to, add a couple of other subsidiary revenue streams along with the donations as well. And that also all have to do with providing more employment to women at the doorstep and in other areas where we're currently not able to do so. So we're working in majority Muslim-dominated communities where a large proportion of the women have come from North India and are not allowed to work at all. So even though we are located in those communities and we're asking women not to step out much further, it's just to come down from their houses, their buildings, and then just come to this unit area. There are some women who are still not able to do that. And so we want to be able to provide them with employment at home. And for that, we are in touch with a couple of organizations that, can provide them. And we're also providing them with vocational skills and also being able to loop in men are through that and be able to earn revenue for the organization as well as for the women at the, you know, at home who require this money.
And you mentioned that most of these women have never worked in their lives because they've not been allowed to work. So do you have a recruitment process in place for these women where you provide training as well for a period of time? Do you have like an entire process set up for that?
Yeah, so we have so most of the women that have joined us, this is the first ever job they've done. But our screening criteria is usually not actually looking at people that have never worked before. It is looking at women that are needy and either currently have a positive outlook in terms of learning or could have. So, you know, in the past, we have taken girls who have come to us in a very mentally unstable state, you know, almost committed suicide, HIV positive. And, you know, just every person's case is just so different. But in each case, we've known that that girl has the potential to look forward and to learn and make something in her own life, which she has not had the chance to before. And all we're doing is providing her with the opportunity and the platform to do that. So, you know, once we have that pretty much settled within the organization, everybody knows that this is how we hire. You know, we have the right kind of references coming in and the women coming in. For each woman that comes in, we have a 15-day training process where for that time, it's a testing period for both of us to see whether we would fit in, because it is a very challenging environment where everybody has to take initiative. Nobody's told that this is your target, this is your job, and this is what you need to do every single day. Every single day looks different, even for the women that are in the production, because, you know, one day we're producing, then the other day they're actually going out educating somebody, then the third day they're actually holding a camp, the fourth day they're again making pads, and the fifth day they're making use of a bag for disposal, and, like, you know, it's all kinds of things, and you know, we take their ideas very seriously. So when our own women say things like, you know, we actually want to, we actually would rather study menstrual hygiene a little bit more before we go into the community. We get gynecologists to come in and teach them that instead on a day or two. And so we really leave this very open. So that's essentially the type of people that we're looking for as well. And no, again, no age group barrier or anything in this sort. We have 18-year-olds, we have 55-year-olds, all working under the same position in the organization.
And how many women have received employment through your foundation?
I would say overall it's probably around 60 or so. Yeah, at different points.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that you have women from different age groups. You got really young women working and women on the other end of the spectrum as well. So how has this particular opportunity that your foundation offers changed their lives? Because I'm sure your foundation has offered these women more opportunities in that they never had before. Like, you know, I'm sure like young girls now are capable of going to school maybe or paying for like tuition fees. So have you been able to follow this like progress within their lives?
Yeah, so I mean, unfortunately, we've only been around as an organization for 2.5 years. So that track record is not very long. But from what we do know and what we have, we know that there are girls that have come to us initially not wanting to do anything in their lives at all. And coming here, staying here for, say, a year or 2 years and actually realizing that what they wanted to do was go back to school. And they had been out of school for like 7 or 8 years. And they did. They started doing courses and we supported them in that. We paid for their courses. So in that way, we've seen that people have gone back to their educational aspirations, which they might have not had earlier. We've also had situations where, you know, like the 55-year-old or 50-year-old women who have children who they had removed from school because they couldn't afford to send them to school, who have now basically taken a very strong stance that my daughters will go back to school or will start working and then not sit at home uneducated and unemployed, which is actually the situation for many young girls in urban slums today. In our surveys that we've done on, you know, over 1,200 girls in the very community that we're based in, we've found that over 90% of girls that we surveyed and who were there were all unemployed. And this was at various points of time in the day, and we like kind of randomized which houses we were going to, and yet we found the statistic, which was very surprisingly high. And so in this case, we realized that that there's just a lot of scope, and any woman that we would kind of employ would be given this kind of an opportunity to do something else in their lives, whether it's educational, which we've seen happen before in the organization, or if it's career-oriented. So a lot of the girls that had come to us earlier, they have now moved up in their ladder in the organization itself, which is something that normally a lot of slum-based businesses are not able to do, which is provide people with an aspiration within the organization. And here, because we've been able to provide that, a lot of people stick around for much longer and want to stay here for a longer period of time.
And you mentioned earlier that the women who are working with Maina Mahila, they have a variety of jobs that they're performing on a day-to-day basis. It could be making the pads, it could be going door-to-door selling these pads or raising awareness. Are these women in any way self-employed? Like, do they work on commission basis based on the number of pads that they're generating or the number of pads they're selling? Or is it a fixed term employment? Is it like a full time employment role?
So they actually have a base salary, and then they have commission on top of that salary. So because sales is not their only job, if we were only employing women for sales and education, then I think we would do some kind of a commission model. But because they're doing everything else, they have a salary, and then anything that they're selling is just on top of that. They also have bonuses and benefits and things alongside that.
And so women face challenges accessing sanitary pads and male-run medical stores, unaffordable costs, and stigma and shame associated with menstruation. This is something that we saw in a quote. So how does Maina Mahila go about tackling all three of these problems separately?
So with the three problems, you mean shame, stigma, confusion?
Yeah.
So for shame and stigma, I think it's... actually even confusion. So what we mean by that statement is that when a woman right now has to buy a packet of pads or whatever she needs to buy for managing her periods, she has to go to a chemist shop today and announce to a male shopkeeper that this is, you know, she wants a packet of pads in front of all these male customers and male bystanders who are all then like looking away from her because they all think that, you know, she said something that's really embarrassing for her and for them to hear. And they look away, and they finally, you know, the male shopkeeper gets out a packet of pads, he wraps it up in layers of newspaper, puts it in a black plastic bag, and then gives this to her, and she looks down, she makes the payment, and then she further covers it up in her dupatta and then walks away. So that whole process involves this kind of shame that, you know, what am I carrying? You know, am I carrying something that I shouldn't be carrying? But if it's something that's so normal, then why should you not be carrying it? So we, for that particular case, we have started a pad packet parade, which is essentially women carrying packets of pads in public and being completely normal with it. So we have videos of girls going to chemist shops and taking the packets and then refusing to wrap it up in layers of newspaper and then just carrying the pad packets home. And that's kind of a norm that we wanted to set within those slum communities as well as in just communities in general, because this is definitely not limited by socioeconomic class, this kind of stigma that exists. With the confusion, we realize that has a lot to do with accurate education being provided, and that, you know, even if women know what a pad is, or they have heard of something called a pad, or they have heard of something called a tampon or a cup or whatever product they may be comfortable using, they still don't exactly know how to use it appropriately. So using a cloth is not a bad thing, but not using it well is a bad thing, which is essentially not drying it under direct sunlight and not soaking it for enough time in water. And so in those kinds of situations, we want to ensure that the women are tackling their menstrual hygiene properly, and they're not just using products that are available but they don't really know how to use. And so in that sense, we're trying to clear that confusion that they have, because when we go at the doorstep, we provide them with enough education that they would need in terms of how many hours should we be changing the cloth or the pad, how many pads would you need in a single day, then how will you dispose the pad, how do you actually stick it onto an underwear, why it's important to wear an underwear in the first place, and then so on. And so a lot of these, and also how do you link them up with gynecologists and doctors as well? So we provide those referral services because we experience a lot of complaints from girls and women talking about how their periods are very irregular or extremely heavy flow, extremely bad cramps, and they don't know what to do. infertility cases, cases of having vasectomies done, but done and gone wrong, and so on. We figured out that, you know, obviously menstrual hygiene is not in isolation, and we have to work in a whole ecosystem of problems here, and everything is linked to each other. And so in that confusion, people are confused about so many more things here, which we need to tackle step by step, so people have accurate information at the doorstep.
So just to put things in perspective, Suhani, for our listeners, do you know by any chance what the average price of a sanitary pad in India is?
So sanitary napkins come in hundreds of varieties, and not just in brands, but in types. So an average price for, I would say, a medium-sized sanitary napkin in Indian rupees would be possibly somewhere around 40 to 50 rupees or so for a packet of, say, 6 or 7 pads. This is like for a medium size kind of a pad. Then we have the extra large pads, and then there's the double extra, the XXL or the double L pads, which are essentially the pads that are used for all night purposes, and also for, you know, either heavier women, much older women, and so on as well. So because different age groups have different pad varieties that are suitable for them, and they would have different average prices depending on the type of quality of the pad, as well as compostability and materials that are used in the pad, the thickness of the pad, length of the pad, and things that go into this as well. So I really don't think that it's kind of fair to have an average price for a sanitary napkin, because it really varies a lot.
No, but still, I was just thinking that you managed to keep your pads at a very affordable rate of 25 rupees, which is pretty much like half the price that you mentioned earlier. And I was wondering how you managed to keep the pads affordable at 25 rupees without compromising on quality.
Yeah, so the 25 rupee pads are straight pads without wings. So the moment we add wings, the cost increases. So we also have pads that have wings. And those are actually worth 40 rupees right now that we are giving out. And actually, we also have a variety that is 35 rupees with wings as well. And here we've made sure that the quality is not compromised at all, but that the cost is at our cost, so that we are not losing, but we're not gaining anything, because here we're an NGO in how we're functioning. But in this case, you know, we really have to ensure that we are providing something that is an aspirational product for women, and not just a low-cost product given to people in low-income communities. It should be a very high-quality product given to people in low-income communities as well. So I basically, the type of pads that I'm using or my friends are using are the exact pads that we are giving out. So I think it's not compromising that at all. And I think the only way that we've been able to, I guess, maintain the costs low is that we've been very stringent on our expenses. Like we've really only spent a penny when it is really needed. That penny has not been spent otherwise, and that accounting is done very clearly. And that's very rare in a disorganized sector, in an urban slum kind of a setting. But we've somehow managed to do that, and we want to maintain doing that so that we can maintain these low costs.
Now, just to go back, and I hope I've not misunderstood, you mentioned that some women who were refusing to come out and work, they could work from home sometimes. So how did they really contribute?
So that's a separate vocational skills training project, which is where we provide them with stitching skills. And those women...
Okay, so that has nothing to do with the pads then?
No, it does have nothing to do with the pads. It's more about employment. So Men and Mother Foundation is actually not a menstrual hygiene company. It is a company that provides employment, and menstrual hygiene is one of the means in which we do so.
So Hani, you serve in 12 slum development areas in Mumbai. How many slums are there in Mumbai in general?
There is no such statistic.
No?
We can make up a number, like 25 or 30 or something, but it's somewhere around that. But yeah, there's, in fact, I mean, this is something that people are struggling with big time. And I think a lot of the Silicon Valley startups and all are really involved in drone satellite technologies for how do we map slums so that we know how many slums there are, what are the boundaries look like, because we have no idea when a slum begins or ends. So it kind of is just like a sprawling, an entire landscape of just a slum, but we don't know if that's 1 or 10 or how many. And we have no idea on the demographics either. So this is, you know, either we base it off of estimates or we collect data ourselves. And we've realized that we need to collect data ourselves as well. So in every community that we go to, we first profile them to the extent that we can, so that we have a general sense of how many medical stores are here, how many government clinics are here, how many doctors sit here, how many schools exist, how many police stations are here. And then how many households on average could be staying in this part of the community. And then we kind of base it off of that. So that's why we say 12 slum areas, because we have no idea how many slums in general are there.
Right. And how many women have you reached in the last 2.5 years, approximately?
So we reach about 10,000 women a month. And some of them, I would say about 5,000 or so of them, so about 50% are repeat. And so we're reaching, I think over the last 2.5 years, though it hasn't been a constant rate, we might have reached more than 50,000 women.
Mm. And I know you've just started off as a foundation and you're getting, you know, funding and everything, but do you have ideas to branch out into different cities and different, possibly even different countries as a foundation?
So we have a very clear focus on urban slum areas. And so we want to make sure that we are covering the most complex and urban slum structure in India, which is definitely in Mumbai. And then next we have on list actually two tribal areas that are in Maharashtra state, but that are peri-urban. They're slum communities kind of in peri-urban areas. And that's where we're kind of thinking of expansion next, because that's a different type of a landscape slightly. And we want to make sure that we're able to provide these products to those people there which have absolutely no access to any means currently. And then the third thing on our list is Delhi. That's the second highest number of or like percentage of the population of Delhi living in slum communities. So in Bombay, about 50% of the population lives in slums. In Delhi, it's about 27%, which is the second highest in the country. So that's where we probably want to go.
Just to talk about the part of your project dealing with education and more conversations about menstruation, I was wondering if you'd heard of the Menstrupedia magazine?
Yeah. We definitely use that for our health camps as well.
Oh, okay.
Right. Wonderful. Because we happened to interview Aditi Gupta. For any of our listeners who are interested, we spoke to her in episode 40. And it was one of the best conversations we've had. I feel like I say this a lot, but it was very insightful about the way she went about tackling the topic of menstruation in schools and among children. And that led me to wondering how you guys at Maina Mahila tackle this conversation, especially when it gets a bit difficult to broach within slum communities.
Yeah, I think, we work with the community to design the very programs that we're running. So I'm the only person essentially who was involved in the founding team and is kind of still involved now other than the interns that we have, who is not from the slum community. So from our managers to our accountants to our supervisors, production, sales, everything is all women from the community. And so that makes it much easier for us to start these conversations, because these women themselves used to use old rags or more unhygienic practices of managing their menstrual cycle. And so it becomes easier for them to explain to others that, you know, this is what I used to do, and this is how this has changed my life, and this is how it can change yours as well. And because it's not somebody who they're not familiar with who's coming to say them to talk to them about all of these things, they're more likely to listen. So though we have received a lot of pushback from new communities where we go, where people don't necessarily recognize our faces, and there it's, you know, again, where we're talking in front of husbands and a lot of male members are around, the women feel very shy, we make it a point to note down their address and go back to those houses again and again. And we have focus group discussions in those particular areas where people are most uncomfortable to talk about this, so that we can understand exactly what their constraint is. Because usually those are the women that we should be first targeting, because that's probably the most vulnerable segment as well. So I think we have in a large part faced less of that that uncomfort here, because we've gone through those conversations with our own women first, and now they go over those same conversations at the doorstep with other women, making it much easier. And then for the areas where we do have a lot of this still continuing and a lot of these challenges, we just keep going back. So there's not, I mean, I think I would definitely say that there's not a single woman that we have ignored just because she has said, I don't want to talk about this topic, and that we've left her. That has never happened.
So, Suhani, we know many organizations who are doing work which is very similar to yours and also trying to break the taboo of periods. We have, you know, India's Padman, as most of us have probably seen the latest movie as well. But I was just wondering, what does your organization do differently? Because it seems like your organization seemed to gain a bit more traction than possibly some other smaller organizations. And as you mentioned, you know, you're getting funding as well, which maybe the other organizations don't. So there are many people in India doing this kind of work. So is there anything different that you're possibly doing?
So I would comment less on what the others are doing, but I can comment on what we're doing differently, I guess. So what we've generally seen is that Menamela Foundation has really stuck by its roots where it was started, which was we started with grassroots level women, and that's where it will all end as well. So it's managed entirely by them. So we don't have women workers. We have women managers who are from the local communities. And that in itself is actually a pretty distinctive factor because a lot of organizations have women as employees within the organization from the local community, but the profits and the business and the strategies are all actually designed by somebody else. We are also not part of a textile industry or a business, which is actually what a lot of sanitary napkin manufacturers in India are. This is their side business, and they're actually, a lot of them are textile manufacturers. Their actual goal and their money-making part is something else, and it's something that can get them easy bucks because they can get government tenders and sell this off to them, and the government doesn't care about quality, and so you just give out free pads to girls who will not complain because they receive pads for free. And so we're, you know, we're of course very different from those kinds of organizations in that. That's not something that we've been ever looking for, is that government kind of a tender traction. And the third thing is that we are constantly innovating on our product at all levels. So yes, we are a very regional organization. We are trying to create a more unified brand that's synonymous with affordable women's health at the doorstep. It's not restricted to sanitary napkins. It is all about informed product choice. And it is actually pretty progressive in that we're trying to think about sexual and reproductive health alongside. We're also working on cervical cancers. We're working on breast cancer screenings. We do anemia. We work on TB. So we're trying to work on a couple of and a whole range of things at the doorstep as well. And at the same time, standardize a model that we could do at scale. So it is not a regional, and it is not supposed to be a regional NGO in the future, I guess, the way that we're envisioning it. Where it would just, you know, be kind of scattered, and you would have hundreds of different brands and hundreds of different organizations creating their own pad units all over the country. It's definitely not a pad unit. It's a movement. And it's a movement towards more affordable women's health. So I guess that's probably, and in terms of Padman, you know, what they do is incredible. But what they do is very different too from what we're doing. They manufacture machines. And that's what a lot of the low-cost sanitary napkin, you know, I guess the various industries in this, they are either making the machines or providing them the raw materials, or they're actually making the pads. And in that case, actually, they're providing the machines to make the pads by other self-help groups all over the country. And because it's done by self-help groups, the self-help groups can't necessarily manage this as at scale or with the kind of branding and strategy that they might need to be able to actually reach maximum houses with the efficiency that the capacity of the machine. And so they're not usually able to reach that. And a lot of them go bust. So actually majority of the machines that are being distributed across the country that are low-cost semi-automated machines are not being used at all. They've just been distributed. And it's a really hep thing today to have a sanitary napkin unit. And so people do. But if there's no impact from that, then I guess that's just, you know, it says a lot about the intention and I guess just the lack of strategy and business efficiency in reaching the men.
No, Suhani, this is something I found on your website, that according to the India National Family Health Survey in 2015 to 16, 58% of women in India from the age group of 15 to 24 use sanitary pads. So I was wondering if it's safe to assume that the rest of the 42% mostly use rags, or is this taking into consideration women who prefer tampons maybe?
So the way the question was designed in the National Family Health Survey, there was only one question about this, and it said, what do you use during your menstrual cycle? Somewhere around those lines. And it was a multiple answer, multiple choice question. So we know from our own research as well that women that are using pads in rural and in urban slum kind of areas, they are not necessarily using pads exclusively. So say you have ticked pads for that question, you might have also ticked cloth or leaves or anything else in that list. And so even that 58% that you're reading there, it doesn't necessarily have to mean exclusively 58% are using sanitary napkins here. And so it could really have a very different interpretation. So I really would not think or dig deeper into what the interpretation of that statistic is, because that statistic itself is not very meaningful. We don't have any good statistic at a national scale about where we lie in menstrual hygiene in India today, because we just don't have that nuanced number.
Right. But have you ever had any conversations surrounding tampons with these women? I'm assuming it must be quite a struggle to get the idea across and to have them open-minded enough to try something like this, even when they're a little conservative about sanitary pads itself. So has the conversation surrounding tampons ever come up?
So when we brought it up, this is something that we, of course, we know about the cultural barriers and things here as well for unmarried girls. For married girls, it's slightly easier. There's not necessarily a direct benefit of using tampons over sanitary napkins. There are benefits over cups with sanitary napkins, and people often compare those two. But I would definitely argue that there's a fight that you have to make to get over that barrier of stigma to surrounding this, and you would much rather do that for a cup than for a tampon. When a pad is serving the same purpose as a tampon, it's as disposable and it's creating as much of a hype around this. And in fact, a tampon is a lot more risky because women in these communities are not changing it in every 6 hours. And if you don't change it in every 6 hours, you're at risk of toxic shock syndrome. And that's not something that we would want to subject these women to. So if we start these conversations and say they're okay with using tampons and they start using them, if they don't manage it properly and there's a death in the family, the entire community would never use even a pad again. And so that's not something that we can subject them as risk to. So yeah, it sounds great on paper, and we can say, yes, we should have informed product choice around tampons, but there's no direct benefit of having tampons over pads. So why should we? But yes, we do talk about this in the community that you have all of these different options, but we recommend this for you if you cannot change it in every 6 hours. And there's no direct benefit of this in terms of having less things to dispose, and hence if you want to switch to something that's more eco-friendly, say, and you have access to hot water to sterilize your cup, then you can use menstrual cups instead. Because if you're okay with inserting something up your vagina, then you should be okay with a menstrual cup over a tampon.
So Honey, when you first started this foundation, what was the biggest challenge that you had to overcome?
I think it's a challenge that we still have to work with, which is how do you manage, how do you run a company where community leaders are running it, and in a way that is as effective and efficient and is able to scale. So this is something that when we started, we made this conscious decision that we're not going to have a team of MBA students coming into teachers' business and we're going to create this ourselves. We knew that we were getting into something that was just going to be a very rudimentary kind of a model, and also something that the community members and donors needed to be acceptable of. So we had lots of questions from donors being like, I was a 20-year-old young Indian girl, still a student in college, starting this, along with these community leaders who had never had any experience working on any FMGC product or any kind of a business experience before. So with such a background, and we were starting this company, people questioned us a lot on our credibility, questioned us a lot on, you know, is this something that you guys really think you can pull off? Who is really the brain behind this? And they kept looking for that man. They kept looking for that back-end accountant, like finance guy who is actually managing all of the budgeting. And they found none. And so, you know, that's where a lot of questions did start. And then a lot of this recent press, I think, has really helped with that credibility and has put a lot of those questions at ease. It's kind of put a stamp on us and being like, you know, you guys are working on important stuff and we want to continuously support you. And I hope that other organizations do the same.
Now, we mentioned in the beginning, Suhani, how yours was one of the only organizations from India that was invited to the royal wedding. So, begs the question, how did Meghan Markle, the now Duchess of Sussex, first find out about you?
So, I met her in 2016 at a Glamour College Women of the Year Award ceremony. And that was when she was mentoring one of the other girls. So, there were 10 of us who were given awards at that ceremony. And she was a mentor for one of the other girls. Each of us was paired with a mentor. And through that, you know, they're giving me the grand prize and they were explaining what the problems that we were tackling at Through Men and Mena Foundation was in India. And she was very touched by some of the statistics that she heard and some of the challenges that she wanted to see firsthand. And so she'd reached out being like, I actually want to see what you're doing. And hope that, you know, I can make it down to India. She came down a couple of months later and she was with us. She spent some time looking at all the work that we are doing and really liked that everything was being done by the women themselves. You know, like we had no special programming for her. It was all, you know, all the lunch was made by them. It was their own kind of home food. She was sitting on the ground chatting with all of us. We don't have anything fancy. It's just a very homegrown setup. And I think she really connected with the fact that we were really not spending money on anything that was obnoxious. And it was all going into the hands of what we were actually saying it was going for. And so I think she found it to be an organization that if she supported, the money would go into the right hands. And hence, I guess she's been a great support for us ever since.
And Suhani, just to round off this interview and, you know, the great work that you're doing at the foundation, I'm sure a lot of our young listeners, whether they're in India or maybe even in other parts of the world, they might want to get involved and maybe even volunteer. So how can they go about that?
Yeah, so essentially first visit our website, which is www.menamehla.com, which has a page on jobs. And, you know, you can also just contact us, send us an email saying that, you know, hey, I'm looking for an opportunity to work in education and, you know, would love to see if I can talk to some of your girls about stress management or talk to some of your girls about self-defense or anything. I would love to hear from them. We'd love to hear from doctors and gynecologists because we're trying to create a gynecologist network now of people that we can consult. We would also just love to have people that are based in Mumbai and would like to come and drop by, would like to see the organization, see and speak to the women, interview them as well. It would be great. To just, you know, hear their thoughts and have them, you know, learn from us as well. And we'd love to have people contribute to us through design, through finance, any special skills that the people have as well would be really useful.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, Suhani, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us and thank you for giving us your time. We've had an amazing time talking to you about this project and we do hope that more people would be willing to volunteer with you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in as always. And thank you, Suhani, for giving us your time. We understand you're running on a very busy schedule. We really, really enjoyed speaking to you. And as always, if you have any questions for Suhani, for either of Ankita or myself, you can drop us a mail to mail@desioutsiders.com.
Please be sure to follow Suhani. She has already told you how to go about that. And while you're on social media, please be sure to check us out on social media too. We are at They Say Outsiders on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, everywhere pretty much. And we'd be very, very grateful to you if you could leave us a review on iTunes.
So until next week, I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And we're the They Say Outsiders.